Great. And with that, we're all set to go. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. So I just want to take a moment to go over today's agenda. We're going to do a quick overview of the tenancy webinar series and the goals for that series. We're going to spend some time looking at what states wanted to accomplish and sort of an aggregate review of what you told us that you wanted to accomplish in this area. And the two major areas we wanted to go over are related to the housing informational bulletin. So some of this might be review, but we felt it was really important to have that context moving into our discussion of the conducting the crosswalk for housing-related services and funding sources. And that's sort of the part I think is going to be exciting for folks to think about and act upon. So supporting Tennessee webinar overview and goals. We have three main sessions that are going to occur in February, March, and April. Today's session, I've already talked a little bit about what we're going to be doing. I think the main thing here is the crosswalk and the discussion of the authorities that you might already have services operating in. And then in March, we'll be looking at a few examples of housing-related services, state examples, and having presentations there. And then in April, we're going to talk about implementation planning based on the lessons learned and experiences from the states. And that's, I think, where the rubber hits the road and gives you an opportunity to really think about how to expand upon the work that you've already been doing. So the CMS goals for this, we have a couple of goals that we wanted to lay out on the table to be, you know, clear. We want to assist the states with understanding the services from our perspective, so we're working together and pulling in the same direction. They're easier to define, but it's important, you know, that we are talking the same language with regard to moving forward. And the second goal is to increase the state adoption of housing-related services. Many of you are already participating in the Money Follows a Person program, and as an option in the Money Follows a Person program, many of you, almost all of you who responded to a simple poll back in 2013 indicated that you have tenancy support services of some type, transition services, in your operational protocols or in development. And at the time, I think we had 33 states in, I think we had 33 states respond, and we had 28 states that said they already had those services in their programs. But only a little over 50% of the respondents had moved some of those services into their waiver programs and state plan programs. And outside of just a couple in who are using some state plan supports, there's really only those were the only two authorities that were really discussed in the poll. So we're excited about the opportunity to expand upon that and figure out how to make those services effective with you. And then finally, for my part here, I just wanted to mention, you know, that part of the, I think the exciting part of this effort is that we're working together with multiple agencies, federal partners, and listed on this slide are just a litany of different informational bulletins and activities that we've been working on with HUD and SAMHSA. And we're excited to have them as partners and thought leaders and supporting our efforts as well. So I just wanted to, again, thank everybody before I turn the call over, and thank you again for everything. And we're going to have a little quick poll here to see if we can gather some information from you. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much. And this is Hannah from Nashby again. So if you could all just fill out this poll, I understand what housing-related services are allowable under Medicaid, and indicate whether you strongly agree, agree, neither agree, nor disagree, disagree, or strongly disagree. That would be great. Okay, so I'll leave it open for just a couple more seconds. Okay, great. Thank you all for your input here. It looks like most people agree, followed by disagree. So it seems like we are slightly split here. And so the next polling question we have for you is, my state has the information necessary to create a strategy to implement HRS in its Medicaid program. And again, please indicate if you strongly agree, agree, either agree nor disagree, disagree or strongly disagree. Great, I'll keep it open for just a couple more seconds. Okay, great. And it looks like most people neither agree nor disagree. Okay, and with that, I will pass it along.
Great, thank you. This is Melanie Starn, and we're just going to take a couple of minutes here to share some commonalities with you. We have a lot of different states with lots of different interests on the line, but we wanted to share with you a couple of things where you have information and ideas in common. And in this first slide, we took the expression of interest forms that states submitted and aggregated the target populations that you all had identified you were seeking to serve in this IAP project. And so you can see that we have a wide range of target populations, ranging from super utilizers and those with complex needs to people with behavioral health and substance abuse needs. And then finally, the most popular, most common one that we found in the expressions of interest was that you were wanting to focus these efforts on people who are currently homeless or have been chronically homeless. Okay. We did the same process with your desired outcomes that were expressed in the IEP applications for this piece. And again, you can see there was a range of interests, but also many commonalities. And so I won't read them off to you. You can read them there, the five different most common areas. But the ones that are highlighted in red will be those that we focus on in this webinar series. So helping states better understand and use Tennessee support services. That's one at the bottom, and that's had the highest interest. And I think our polls just bear that out. People want to learn more about this area. And then providing information about provider development and capacity building. And then finally, assisting states in developing a plan to implement these services. Okay. So there are four things that we recommend states do. You'll be hearing more about this throughout this session today, that we recommend you do as part of your participation in the webinar series. The first thing is to establish and convene a housing-related services state team. And hopefully many of your or some of your team members have already been identified and maybe even are attending the webinar here with you today. And then, of course, attend the three web-based workshops, these three webinars, this one being the first. And then before the second webinar, and this, we'll discuss this later in this session today, before the second webinar, complete a state crosswalk of housing-related services, current funding sources, and the available Medicaid options. And then finally, at the end of the series, we'll give you the tools to develop a tenancy services strategy to develop an implementation plan for your internal use within the state as you move forward in housing-related services support. Thank you. I look forward to working with you. And next up is Lynn Kovich from the Technical Assistance Collaborative. Lynn?
Thank you, Melanie. I'm sorry, I advanced the slide deck a little too quickly. So I'm, as Melanie said, Lynn Kovich from the Technical Assistance Collaborative. Good afternoon, everyone. Really happy to be part of this whole collaboration and this first webinar, kickoff webinar this afternoon. So I'm just going to spend a few minutes the next few slides talking about some housing topics, some housing terms, and the current slide that you see in front of you, the importance of cross-agency partnerships. And as Melanie said, the importance is really for you guys to convene your team to take you through the through these next series of webinars, today being the first. And as you see on the chart, hopefully those folks you have assembled with you who are either listening with you or in your own individual offices. But I think the most important point to this slide, and certainly I think really the genesis of this entire IAP process, is around the partnership. So if you kind of look at the Medicaid state agency and then your housing agencies, and then the third, you could kind of fill in the blank with the agencies really on the right. So your state developmental intellectual disability services agency, your behavioral health agency or the mental health authority, the state unit on aging or adult services, the area agencies on aging. So on that right side are really your service providers, service entities. And in many cases, in terms of aligning the partnership, really these agencies may already be providing with other revenue sources a lot of the services that we'll talk about today, with the potential for using Medicaid to reimburse for those services. So you really want to have a coordinated strategy with Medicaid and those service agencies so that you're developing, and we'll get to this in a little bit, but that crosswalk to kind of walk you through what you're doing now and what you want to do in the future, defining the services and then defining the appropriate funding source. And then on the left part, you can't do this without the ability to fund and develop additional housing resources. So certainly your housing finance agencies, your agencies that are overseeing all of the HUD programs, your local public housing authorities, the continuum of care entities, your HUD field office, as well as the Department of Agriculture, and then you need someone who will provide the services to the individuals, so your supportive housing providers and your other types of service providers, as well as the housing developers. And many of you, as we've gone through the expression of interest process, it's clear many of you have already established these kinds of partnerships. And so we're hoping that as we take you through this series, that you'll really solidify those partnerships and continue to move forward. The other piece that I want to make sure I mention is really working with your governor's office rep and your state office, your state budget office. So very, very important to involve them early on, to have buy-in to the strategy, to identify resources, to make sure that it's part of the priority. So really important to have those two offices at the table with you as well, and some included. Some of you may have them with you today. You certainly included them in your application. Okay, so I'm hoping that we have a mix of housing folks on the webinar as well as our service folks. So, you know, really want to make sure that you understand each other's language. And the housing system is quite complex, and I'm going to spend just a few minutes here, where this probably could be a bit of an 8-hour training. So really just want to throw some terms out at you and give them some definition so that there's a real basic understanding. And again, many of you probably are very familiar with the terms and really understand. And so for those who don't, try to make it, you know, as simple as possible. So the first bullet really talks, I think, about resources, about subsidies for folks. And if you kind of look at the HUD world, the Housing Choice Voucher Program is really almost not a catch-all, but the biggest program that funds rental assistance for people who are low income, for people who are elderly, and for folks who have a disability. So the bullet there, mainstream, really targeted for probably folks who are low income in general. And then when you start to talk about folks with disabilities, there are special purpose kinds of vouchers that are targeted for folks who have a disability. And so one that probably will resonate with you are the NEDs, the non-elderly disabled vouchers, that we were able to take advantage of a few years ago and continue to do so. The important thing about the special purpose vouchers is they are targeted for people with disability. And as they turn over or as folks move off them, they remain for folks with disability. So they continue to be a targeted source even upon turnover. They're typically, I say typically, but I'll talk about something else in a second, but tenant-based, in that folks can take the rental assistance, take the voucher, and rent an apartment on the market, typically using fair market values, with fair market rents, and as long as the unit itself meets program requirements. So the NED voucher that I just spoke about is a tenant voucher. The person, him or herself, can go and rent an apartment on the market. There are also project-based housing resources that the rental assistance is tied to the project. So a good example of that would be the new Section HUD 811 TRA. So really attaching that subsidy to that particular project. So if someone moves, they don't take that subsidy with them. It stays with the property. And many of you are familiar with that because you were successful 811 applicants in the 12 and 13 rounds. And then, so we talk about the entities that you would work with as you're developing this strategy. So there are public entities, there are nonprofit and for-profit entities. So on the public side, it's typically your public housing authority. There could be public housing authorities at the local level, at the state level, at the county level, and sometimes some state, there are some state entities that are public housing authorities. Also, the Housing Finance Agency certainly would be part of this entity of groups that you would work with. And then, you know, on the ground, you need those developers, so community development corporations that are typically nonprofit housing developers. You also will work with private developers, for-profit developers. Now, a lot of relationship building here with the developers to really understand the folks who we're working with, the types of housing that folks will need. So really, really emphasize the partnerships that need to be developed to be able to further the development of housing. And then the funding agency. So certainly your state and federal agencies, typically the Department of Agriculture, certainly HUD, and then at the state level, the Community Development Office, your Housing Finance Office, and even at your local level on the county level, county community development offices as well. Okay, and then finally, just a little bit about the different types of assistance that really are available. So when you talk about supportive housing, affordable housing development, you really talk about the capital, the bricks and mortar to build it, the rental assistance or the operating, and then the service dollars. So the low-income housing tax credit provides capital only, probably the largest source of funds to develop affordable housing for folks who are low income. Though the low income housing tax credit provides a ton of affordable housing, in many cases, folks who we are working with, folks with disabilities, folks who are at extremely low incomes may not still be able to afford the tax credit program. So by working with states, with your housing finance agency, able to provide a deeper subsidy to make those units affordable. So they're typically affordable to people at 60% of AMI. So to add that an additional subsidy to allow our folks who we're working with to access those units. So the 811 program is a very good example of that, working with the tax credit developments and properties to attach the subsidy to make it affordable to folks who we're working with. And some states already have their own kind of targeting for their low-income housing tax credit programs that do make it affordable, and now we have the additional resource through the HUD 811 program. The Housing Choice Voucher is rental assistance only, And you can see we talked about that in our in the previous slide. The home program provides capital and rental assistance for folks who are low income as well as folks who have a disability. And I think so many of you probably have also worked with home on your state or county level. I think the important thing to understand, and many of you probably do, is that a housing project is typically a number of funding sources that are braided together to get to the final project. Never a single funding source. There are always multiple funding sources, making it even more complex and kind of difficult to navigate the system. So the kind of takeaway is the complexity of the housing system. And so when you talk about that three-legged stool of capital, and then your operating or your subsidy, and then your services, so that last bullet, really making sure folks have assistance with navigating the housing system. So understanding where the service, what we're going to talk about next, getting into really what the service types are that can be provided, how that has become so important as people are trying to navigate the system with different eligibility requirements. Each property can have different requirements. So it does get very, very complicated. So to ease that for the person and ensure they're connected to the right type of housing, really thinking about housing navigation. So now I'm going to turn it back over to Hannah, and we'll do another polling question.
Great. Thank you so much. So for this polling question, we're asking, what best describes your organization's role in cross-agency partnerships, including services and housing? Or state Medicaid agency, excuse me, other state services agency, state agency overseeing housing, state housing finance agency, local public housing agency, or other? Great, and I'll just give that a few more seconds. Okay, awesome. So it looks like most people said state Medicaid agency, followed by other state services agency. And I will now pass it over to Kevin Martone.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. It's Kevin Martone from TAC. Very good to be here with you today. I just want to drive home the point that Lynn was making about the housing partnerships because, you know, when you think about it from the housing perspective side, not that there's a, we're flush with, housing resources, but, the housing folks will tell you that they can sort of create housing, and housing supply. And, certainly we know we have housing shortages, but, a lot of times there is or can be housing made available for the folks that we're serving. And a lot of times, I know, either in my role in state government or as a provider, we would hear from property managers or landlords, great, I got the person housing, but, what are you guys doing to make sure that they can, maintain themselves in the apartment, pay their rent, be a good landlord, not play music too loud at, 1 o'clock on a Saturday morning, things like that. And I know I spent, a lot of my time when I was doing direct services years ago, working with individuals on, working with them on IADLs and things like that, but a lot of my time and energy was spent on helping them maintain, their housing in the community. And we didn't necessarily think about it in that way back then, but that's the core of what it was. And so, really, as we get into this, the housing-related services conversation, it's really important to provide some of that context. I also think, it's really good that we've had a lot of interest from states on this. It really suggests that, you all are thinking about, housing-related services as an important strategy in your toolbox to support the populations that you serve, and I think that's really important. And hopefully through this next series of slides, we can sort of, break down the housing-related services and what we mean by that so it's not so complex for you, as you begin to, develop or design or implement your strategies in your respective states. So just for some context and framing, I just want to be clear about sort of what we're talking about here. We're really talking about, supportive housing, housing that is integrated into the community, with the rights of tenancy, that it's lease-based, we're not really talking about group homes or residential treatment or transitional housing here, although we will touch on, you know, the respective roles in this process, but I really try to set the stage about the type of housing or settings where the housing-related services, you know, that we're talking about will apply. You know, and I think, you know, states that are, you know, really using or interested in pursuing, you know, this type of model recognize that role, you know, that it supports, you know, a person's, you know, community-based integrated living and that it's known to be, you know, more cost-effective intervention or support or service, you know, versus some of the more costly, you know, long-term care settings that we often have or, in our systems or we're trying to move ahead from. Second bullet about housing-related services, you know, if you look at, you know, what was contained in the informational bulletin, you know, broadly defined, you know, there are a range of flexible supports that individuals can use to get and keep housing. You know, and when you think about it from a broad perspective, you know, work that people are doing, service providers are doing on things like IADLs, you know, in terms of teaching a person to maintain a clean home or manage money, can sort of broadly be considered housing-related services. But what we're really going to be talking about here are more specifically about the tenancy types of services, the pre-tenancy and the ongoing tenancy supports that are directly related to a person's housing to help them succeed in the community. This next slide is really just sort of a visual Venn diagram that just sort of gives you the concepts of visual concepts of what we're talking about. You know, we're talking about, you know, sort of this range of supportive housing and supportive housing services that are out there. We're talking, you know, about this range of community-based long-term services and supports that are out there. And there's obviously a lot of overlap in those. And that central circle there is specifically that overlap, you know, between supportive housing and community-based long-term support services, you know, that are housing-related services that we're talking about here. So who are the potential beneficiaries of Medicaid housing-related services? You know, when we think about the goals that we're working on, we're really working to serve individuals in integrated, cost-effective settings. And for many of those people that we do serve, you know, these settings can be the lease-based supportive housing arrangements that we're talking about. And when you think about it, multiple populations can really benefit from housing-related services. And if you think about this list of folks here, you know, many of the individuals that we're talking about may be coming from a variety of these settings, from institutional settings, you know, hospitals or psychiatric hospitals or nursing homes or intermediate care facilities. You know, they may be coming from different types of residential treatment settings or facilities that may be known as assisted living facilities or residential care homes or adult care homes. And a lot of times, you know the state that you're in, you know, these types of facilities are known by different names in your state depending on what state you're in. You know, obviously people who are coming from homelessness or chronic homelessness settings. People are coming from correctional facilities. Oftentimes, these individuals have a mental illness, a substance use disorder, or other chronic health conditions. You know, people, young adults who are transitioning out of foster care, you know, the homeless numbers there are really high. You know, many of these individuals can benefit from housing-related services. And so, you know, when you think about, you know, housing-related services and how it fits into your, you know, your overall strategies in your state, you know, you may have come to this, you know, webinar or webinar series thinking about one particular population in mind. But when you start to think about this, you know, there could be for some of you, you know, an aha moment, you know, that when you think about supportive housing and housing-related services, that can be applicable to more than one of your priority populations in your system. So, you know, it's really something to think about as you move forward. So, this slide really starts to set up the types of services that we're talking about. It's really pulled from the informational bulletin from CMS from June of 2015 that talks about housing-related services. And in that bulletin, it was split out into essentially two types or two phases of housing-related services. One is, you know, the individual housing and transition services component of the process, and the second part of it is related to you know, the ongoing and tenancy sustaining services once a person actually transitions into, you know, their housing situation. And many of the services that we're talking about are similar in both phases, but it is important to keep in mind that we are talking about two phases here, especially as you start to think about, you know, what it looks like in your state or your system and your design. So getting to it a little bit further, you know, sometimes it's important to just talk about it, you know, almost what it looks like at the ground level. You know, who provides housing-related services? You know, and to some degree, you know, if you're sitting in a Medicaid seat, for instance, you know, I can imagine, you know, that you've heard from various disability agencies or groups, you know, about the different types of titles that essentially can provide these types of services. You know, they may have similar functions, and they may do the same thing, but they may be called different things depending on, you know, the group that you're working with or the type of program that is maybe funding these type of services. You know, for instance, you know, these type of titles that might be providing these services may be called, you know, one thing in an MFP program, like transition coordinators, or, you know, in an assertive community treatment team, you know, the services could be delivered through that model, you know, through a housing specialist or something. And so it's important to sort of think about, you know, sometimes these services are provided by different people with different titles, but they're providing a similar service, you know, case managers, transition coordinators, housing specialists, housing coordinators, just something for you to think about when you're sort of putting this all together in your system. From a funding sources perspective, you know, obviously we're talking about this from a little bit more of a Medicaid perspective here, but I think it's very important to keep in mind that what might not currently be paid for by Medicaid may in fact be currently be paid for by other funding sources in your system. You know, you may have a lot of housing-related services being paid through state general funds through your state mental health authority, or they may be provided through, you know, a HUD funding source like the McKinney Supportive Housing Program or something. So it's important to think about it, even though some of these things may not currently be covered or provided through a Medicaid lens, they may exist in your system and be paid from by another source. And this is an important concept for you to keep in mind in your discussions as you're thinking about it, as you're thinking about, A, how to maximize FFP in your system, B, how to minimize duplication between funding sources, and C, how to coordinate and best use those different funding sources. You know, so at the end of the day, if you are going to try to use Medicaid to cover some of the housing-related services that we're going to talk about, there are going to be certain things that may ultimately not be eligible to be paid for by Medicaid. And how can those important services be paid for by another source so that the system is really working together? And then on the provider side of the world, you know, it's important to think, you know, that, you know, many of these services may be provided by individuals, you know, with certain titles or classifications, you know, or in some instances they may be delivered really through a team-based approach. You know, so for example, you know, some of these services may be provided by an individual's case manager, or they may be provided through an assertive community treatment team by one or more individuals. So the next five slides are really examples of housing-related services. These are all in the informational bulletin from June of 15, and I'm not going to read them all bullet by bullet because you've either seen them or you can certainly read them. But I'm going to sort of kind of talk about a few of them in context to sort of, you know, get the concept out there for you. I think what you'll notice in some of these examples are, from a Medicaid perspective, terminology that you may be familiar with. Coaching, education, you know, assistance with, you know, those types of things that, you know, maybe concepts that you're very familiar with in services that may be currently eligible through, you know, waivers or other state plan services, you know, to help a person succeed in, you know, home and community-based settings. You know, so, you know, providing education, you know, on transportation or education on medication. And I think some of the concept here is really being more explicit or substituting specific housing-related terminology to sort of achieve similar means to an end, okay? And so as we just keep that concept in mind as we're sort of working through these examples. And I think another thing to keep in mind as we're going through them is that, you know, you may in your system already be covering some of these services in, you know, even through a Medicaid lens, but you may need to even think about, you know, how they're currently described or defined in your system to be a little more explicit to support that housing type of intervention that we're talking about. Actually, let me go back one slide. So, you know, in this slide here, you know, you can see the things that we're talking about here. So, for instance, a housing support plan, you know, may identify barriers to succeeding in housing, activities and responsibilities for being a successful tenant, identifying potential supports and interventions to assist the individual, and what things the tenant and housing support staff will do. You know, those are all sort of components that you can sort of think about in a traditional services plan that may be developed for waiver services as well. And, you know, when a person's developing, for instance, maybe a housing support plan for an individual, you know, in some instances that could be provided as part of or incorporated as part of the broader individual service plan for an individual, or in some instances it could be really a discrete document. As long as you're sort of thinking about it from a housing support plan, what can we do, you know, what are the interventions and the roles and responsibilities to support that person in their place of living? You know, on the next slide, for example, the first bullet discusses identifying resources, to help to cover the moving and startup costs. You know, so for instance, as you're working with an individual, you know, the service really is, you know, helping the individual identify, you know, how they'll pay, you know, what resources are needed to pay for security and utility deposits or furniture and furnishings. You know, there's that part of the service right there. But, you know, the other component of that is actually paying for security deposits and utility deposits, you know, which may or may not be possible through Medicaid depending on how, what your state is currently doing through Medicaid. But those are, you know, those are things that's a, you know, a little bit more teased out definition or description of that service. You know, for instance, a housing crisis plan developed prior to tenancy, for example, may identify what will happen if the tenant has significant arrears or is threatened with eviction because of problematic behaviors. And these are all things that you're going to do during that, that transition or pre-tenancy phase of an individual's move into more long-term community-based services. On the next slide, you know, you could think about transition services being performed by facility-based staff and helping an individual contemplate a move and begin the process. So, again, think about it. Many of these individuals are coming from those settings I described for them before. You know, they may be coming from a nursing home or an ICF, for instance. And the person who may be beginning that process with them in the pre-tenancy phase may, in fact, be those facility-based staff. And you have to think about, you know, well, all right, is that, that service at that point already covered by another mechanism? And it may be. And it may be a little bit further down the road, that, that planning process, that contemplation process, or that transition process, that it becomes more of a shared responsibility, you know, where you have an MFP transition coordinator or another community-based service provider who's now been in, identified or engaged to help that person transition into, you know, their next setting. And so you have to think about that when you're designing your services or thinking about it, you know, who's going to provide what services at what point, you know, and where might it be covered. And those are things that you start to get at when we get into the crosswalk conversation. On the next slide, you know, I think an important concept to keep in mind is that the amount and frequency of tenancy-sustaining services, and we're now in sort of the tenancy-sustaining services mode now, right? The person's moved in. But the amount and frequency of tenancy-sustaining services is going to vary by individual. And it's really important not to, to set limits too tight. You know, I've worked with individuals who needed very basic support with, you know, periodic education reminders. But I've also worked with individuals, you know, where interacting with landlords and helping to prevent eviction, you know, are regular occurrences. And as you think about the populations that we're serving, you know, we tend to be serving a more and more complex population in more and more independent and integrated settings. And so we have to really make sure that the services that we're providing out there can be flexible and responsive and intensive when people need that. You know, we have to really, you know, if we're going to really support individuals with highly complex needs, you know, in these settings, we have to value the importance of the tenancy supports really as an integral function or intervention for them to maintain their housing in the community, especially if we think that these settings are better, produce better outcomes, and are more cost-effective than the alternatives like nursing homes and homelessness and things like that. So, you know, in this slide here, I think it's important, you know, just another example of the types of tenancy-sustaining services, just to make it clear for you. You know, an example would be like in the assistance with housing and recertification process, for instance. You know, it may be important for a lot of support from a direct service worker, for a person who may be, really disorganized, a person who's maybe very easily overwhelmed, or a person who, may be psychotic, to really be able to perform that function, that housing recertification process with the housing agency, sufficient to maintain their tenancy, and if you don't get those things completed, it could jeopardize your housing and your tenancy, it could really include planning, with the person about the types of documents that they need to secure, assistance in completing the application or applications that may be related to the recertification process, or assisting the individual, for scheduling a unit inspection, apartment inspection, from the housing folks. And so those are sort of, again, some examples of some of these services and interventions we're talking about. Something to keep in mind as you're contemplating, all right, well, if we're going to think about housing-related services as a Medicaid strategy, what is it going to look like on the ground level? You have to think about, who's going to be performing this, who's going to be tasked with these responsibilities. This role of providing housing-related services may be distinct from other service providers to minimize conflict from housing and services. In some situations where you may have provider-owned or controlled housing, it may be a separate division or department that handles housing functions. In some instances, it could be a very separate agency that's tasked with all the housing functions for a group of individuals, whereas another provider agency or provider agencies are the ones that are providing sort of the traditional, support services that individuals need in community, home and community-based settings. And so it's important for you to sort of think about this, as you're weighing, this out and deciding upon who can bill for tenancy support services, if you go down this road in your system. The next slide just sort of, I think, is really visual to help emphasize that point. Again, all systems are different, right? And you have to really consider, these role assignments when you're developing and designing and implementing tenancy support services and other housing-related support services out there. I think in my experience and our experience at TAC, there's not necessarily a single best approach when you're designing how to provide tenancy support services, but it's critically important to determine who will have specific roles for tenancy support services when you're doing it. So if you think about the individual and you think about the tenant or the service recipient at the center of all of this, there are certain, the more traditional supports that people provide. There may be case management functions that another person provides. Obviously there's the housing and landlord role in a person's life, but then there's the housing-related services component. And you really just have to be very clear, as to who's going to bill that, how you want to set that up in your system. Because it makes it clearer from you from an authority perspective in terms of, authorizing, codes or reimbursement for services. And it also makes it very clear at the provider level because, when you don't have that clarity, that tenancy support service, housing related services function can sometimes fall through the cracks because there's no clear, assignment of roles and responsibilities out there. So I'm going to end there and, we will, I guess, put it over to questions if there are any at this point.
Hey, hi everyone, this is Melanie, and I'm just going to review the questions that we've gotten in the chat box. I think so far there was a comment and a question, and let me just scroll up here. There was a comment from Amber Marker. I'm not sure which slide she's referencing, so Amber, if you want to unmute your line to provide some clarification, please do. The comment was, it sounds as though you were talking about Nebraska RentWise. Nebraska RentWise is a program to help renters obtain and keep rental housing and to be successful renters through education. The program is used by many providers across the state to prepare individuals to be renters. So while we're waiting to see if Amber wants to provide any further information, I'm going to scroll down to the next question, which was from Lori Chris,
who said one of the challenges that we have in Ohio is that sometimes the person receiving pre-tenancy services has a behavioral health condition and may not be engaged to the extent that they have a diagnosis and treatment plan to document medical necessity for the services. How have other states streamlined Medicaid eligibility and treatment planning to support low barrier access to services and housing? So I don't know if Kevin or Lynn, you wanted to talk about any state examples, and then if we have time, and I think we do, maybe we could also open up the line to see if any states want to talk about their experiences.
Yeah, I was just looking at the question. Yeah, I think, I mean, we might get into some of this more in webinar 2 and 3 with state examples. I think there are probably, some situations where there may be streamlined or presumptive eligibility for individuals. I also think that there are, there may be times where this is an area or a gray area where it may not quite be a Medicaid reimbursable service yet for those things that you identified, and it's an area where, other resources are sort of, that's sort of their task is to, maybe use state general funds or things like that, while that process is happening to engage individuals and go through that eligibility process. I don't know if, Lynn, if you have anything to add.
No, that's exactly. And as I talk about in the later part of the presentation, some of the steps to developing the crosswalk, I think that's one of the important things is Medicaid will not cover everything all the time, and there may be other funds that will need to be utilized to do exactly what you're talking about, that kind of outreach activity. And that's really what we would look to use the other funds for, so that you could do that outreach, which is typically not covered until someone is eligible. So we did some of that in New Jersey, and hopefully we're going to continue doing that. Since I've left there, I can't really speak for them any longer, but that was one of our strategies, was to use other funds for those kinds of services.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin and Lynn. So we had another question come in from Lottie Lee from Delaware. It says, for clients that need tenancy services but refuse them, are there any states that make it a requirement to receiving housing? So if we have any of our presenters who'd like to weigh in on that, I'm also going to say that states who'd like to maybe share their experiences, you can unmute your line. I believe is it star 6 or star 7, Hannah? Star 7. Okay.
So this is Lynn again. I'll just quickly jump in terms of how, when I was in New Jersey, how we addressed that. So we did not require services, but what we did ask the provider to do, because many times they still may have had a state subsidy as opposed to moving to a HUD subsidy or other kind of funding source, but we would ask the provider to do a monthly check, and in that monthly check try to engage, and as they were doing that monthly check, hopefully also be trying to build that kind of trust and using things like motivational interviewing to try to engage. Now, we'd have the same question in terms of being able to build that service if they're really not engaging. So, again, that kind of points to the importance of having those other funds available. And hopefully, as that outreach continues, you would be able to engage the person back into services.
Hi, Lynn. This is Harry, and that's thanks for the overview, because that's exactly how we continue to do the services as we separate services from housing, is to still tie that monthly visit to the subsidy. So it still gives us that leverage of seeing the individual to determine if they are still stable or to sort of see if there are some other issues that are happening based on meeting with them in their apartment, in their environment, and continuing to use that time to reengage and so that we can kind of coax them back in, and to also see what other services they may be willing to let us provide them, if not full treatment. But that's exactly what we still do.
Thank you. So we then had a question from Jonathan McVeigh in a TBRA, a tenant-based rental assistance, as a bridge to a permanent subsidy program, how do states recruit PHAs to participate in a waiting list environment?
Yeah,
and
I think
then, we're going to open that up for any of our co-presenters or if those from states would like to share their experience.
Yeah, I'll start, and in some states, if anybody has an example, they could jump in. You know, I mean, it's a good question, and you think when you think about how many housing authorities are out there, there's a lot, right? And I think, you know, some states have taken some different approaches. You know, in some states, they're the, you know, for instance, the maybe a state-level PHA or a state-level housing finance agency or Department of Community Affairs has sort of taken a leadership role in helping to work with some of the local PHAs in a state to facilitate preferences or things like that, you know, in a system. Other times it comes more from a ground level up, either, you know, through provider relationships or engagement with housing authorities or through the local continuum of care to develop some of those relationships. And sometimes there's just no relationships because conversations haven't been had. And there's probably opportunities in many of the PHAs out there to try to figure out ways to materialize, you know, more of the federal rental assistance, you know, by working with them on, you know, homeless preferences or homestead preferences or things like that in states to maybe free up state-funded tenant rental assistance programs.
It really, this is Lynn again. It really is a relationship building kind of exercise. And going back a little bit, when I was working in a provider agency that was a pretty big housing developer, we literally would approach the housing authorities, typically the local housing authorities, to engage them around working with our individuals. And, you know, you could at times talk to them about the services that we would then provide so that if something were going on, they would have the ability to connect with a provider to be able to react to something really quickly, where in many of the other of their buildings or units, they might not have had that. We also, now I'm talking when I was in Pennsylvania and worked in a county environment, And we are, I think, maybe getting into some of Webinar 2 stuff, but was able to engage because we had some resources available, which is always a good thing, and not always, I understand, a realistic thing for some states and even some counties. So I think there's a lot of strategies that we could talk about, but it would be interesting if any of the states have any examples to jump in.
Okay. If any states want to share anything related to that question, it's star 7. Also, there don't seem to be any other questions in the chat box, so if there are any questions that folks would like to pose verbally, please, again, star 7.
Hi, this is Sam Mortka from Illinois Housing Development Authority. And the question of working with the PHAs, one of the ways that we were successful in doing it was with the Section 811 program. The first NOFA gave points for reaching out to PHAs to provide leverage vouchers. And we've actually found that those leverage vouchers are easier to use than the actual 811 program. You know, one of the things that you know, you have to walk a fine line, but one of the things is that most PHAs have really never done outreach into nursing homes when they open their wait lists. And just kindly mentioning that to them and the fact that that may be a violation of fair housing tends to motivate them a little bit more, we found.
Great feedback. Thank you. Hannah, are you able to tell if there are any other verbal questions coming through? Well, actually, it looks like we do have one more question, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name ahead of time, Eluichi Nduike. The question is anyone aware of the continuation or expansion of the capacity building initiative HUD, CMS, and PHAs?
I think this is Mike Smith. I think we've had a capacity building contract that was operational under the Money Follows the Person program, and there is an effort underway to see if we can get that continued. If your state is participating in the Money Follows the Person program, there is limited technical assistance still available through our technical assistance provider there, but it's not as expansive as the capacity building work that was originally going on. I don't know if any of our HUD partners are on today or anybody knows any additional information, but that's what I'm aware of from our division.
Thanks, Mike. Okay. Any follow-up questions? Okay. Then I will turn it over to Steve Eichen.
Great. Thanks, Melanie. I'll talk about the Medicaid authorities. Kevin and Lynn have both mentioned the crosswalk that we'll ask. We'll send a blank version to you next week, and we'll ask you to fill it out to get a sense, kind of a comprehensive sense, as Kevin Martone mentioned, of what supports do people need in this space? How can Medicaid cover it? How can other funding sources cover it? Because Medicaid has its limits, as Kevin articulated. And then on an ongoing basis, you know, what Medicaid authorities might work best for your state and the needs of your population. So I'll give an overview of the Medicaid authorities that are mentioned in the informational bulletin in June 2015. It goes without saying, but we just need to say it. Federal statute does not allow CMS to provide federal funds for room and board in home and community-based services. CMS can assist states with coverage of certain housing-related activities and services, however. And, you know, the next slides show some of the options available. These are options that were identified in the informational bulletin last year. The first option is targeted case management.
Hi, Steve. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're getting a couple of messages that folks are saying it's difficult to hear you. If you could speak up a bit.
Okay. Well, I do my best. Is this better?
It is for me.
Okay.
All right.
All right. So we'll start with Medicaid targeted case management. It's authorized in Section 1905A19 and 1915G. It's defined as services that assist individuals in gaining access to needed medical, social, educational, and other services. It's really a comprehensive case management service. States, when they submit their state plan amendment to provide the service, they determine the target populations for it. You can have more than one targeted case management service in your state. And as I said, it's a comprehensive service. It's really a generalist approach where you have a case manager helping a person across the wide spectrum of needs. As part of identifying a person's overall needs, target case management can include tendency support such as linking people to needed housing resources, helping a person find housing, assisting with identifying resources to support a person so that they can keep housing during a crisis. There's a fair amount of work you can do within that comprehensive support. Now, the drawback of a generalist approach is that housing, as Kevin and Lynn have articulated, it can be very complicated, and sometimes a specialist is necessary to really understand what's going on and to help navigate things efficiently. So the other authorities allow for that kind of specialized or discrete tenancy or housing-related services, and so we'll, you know, TCM may work best for some, other authorities may work best for others. As we move on to the next one, we'll talk about Section 1915C waivers. They allow for home and community-based services that are not otherwise in the state plan. People must need the level of care of a nursing facility, a hospital, or an intermediate care facility for people with intellectual disabilities. And again, as with case management, states determine target populations. I made it a singular or a plural because recent CMS regulations allow for a single waiver to cover multiple populations. Used to be you had to target nursing home level of care or ICFIAD level of care or hospital. Maybe there were special situations where you could do a combination. Now there's more flexibility there. 1915C waivers are, I won't say unique, but they're unusual within Medicaid in that states may limit the number of people that are served and can serve only part of the state. You can waive statewideness, you can pilot an initiative in a particular county or region, and you know, there's good and bad to limiting the number of people. You know, limits risk when you start something new. Obviously limits access when you're providing valuable support. But that's an option that is available in 1915C waivers that is not available in most other Medicaid authorities. The next slide tells us about how we can use Section 1915C waivers for housing-related services. You can provide them within a case management service, much as you can within targeted case management. You can take that generalist approach within a waiver as well. You can also provide separate services specific to transition coordination, helping people move from a facility, or for tenancy sustaining services, supporting people when once they're in a facility. And you could do both together. You know, it's an and or. You could have some continuity across the transition. You can provide environmental modifications necessary for accessibility. You can make the house, get a wider door in the house. You can get a ramp so that people can come in, get a lift so people can get up the stairs. There's a lot you can do with environmental modifications. Also, you can provide expenses to help set up a household. When people have been institutionalized for a long time, they don't have the basics that you need to move in. And the initial nursing home transition states kind of grounds for what could be done to get linens, a variety of, basically what people expect when they're home, to make it a home. And examples that you can do in 1915C are security deposits and utility deposits, essential household furnishings, moving expenses, and services necessary for safety, such as pest eradication. There's a few states that have that service just in their waivers in general, but a lot of states have that within as an option within transition services. On the next slide, we'll talk about Section 1915I. It allows the same services provided in 1915C waivers. It's a state plan amendment, so it's not time-limited, but if you target the population, that you do have to renew it every 5 years. Within 1915I, states define medical necessity criteria, and that criteria must be less stringent than institutional level of care. Long-standing institutional bias was, one way of eliminating that institutional bias would be to get services to people at a less intense level of care. 1915I allows that. States can determine target populations within 1915I. And as in 1915C, states can create discrete housing-related services as described in 1915C waivers. You can also provide tenancy supports within a case management service. Differences with 1915C, services must be statewide, and a state may not limit the number of people served. So, within that target population, you need to serve the folks eligible for the supports. If we move on, the next option is Section 1915K, or Community First Choice. It allows a different option for level of care. It has the same three options as in 1915C, nursing facility, hospital, ICFIAD. And this is only for people under age 21 or age 65 plus, 1915K covers people who meet the level of care of an institution for mental diseases. Medicaid does not cover IMD supports for people age 22 through 64, neither does 1915K. But basically, if Medicaid covers institutional support. 1915K can cover those individuals in the community. 1915K includes attendance services and supports, backup systems, and training to direct attendance. Self-direction is an option within 1915K and an option for the person. And 1915K provides training to direct it, to help people direct those attendants and manage them well. Services must be statewide, and like 1915I, states may not limit the number of people served. There's an incentive to provide 1915K. States must receive 6%, or states receive an extra 6 percentage points in their federal matching rates. For those who don't know, FMAP stands for the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage. It's the share of services paid by the federal government.
Steve, I'm sorry to interrupt again. I'm still getting a few comments from folks that are having difficulty hearing you.
So I don't know what else to do, and I'm sorry that I don't know what's going on with my headset or my phone line, but I just don't know what to do. So I'm trying to get – I've got the microphone right in my mouth, so I don't know what else to do. Should I have someone else present? I mean, is it that faint?
No, Steve, I think you should keep going, just for you to be aware of it. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Okay. I'll do my best.
Okay,
so the second slide for 1915K. At the state's option, they may offer permissible services and supports. These supports include transition costs, such as security deposits, first month's rent and utilities, purchasing bedding, basic kitchen supplies, and other necessities required for transition from an institution. Unlike 1915C and 1915I, there's an extra benefit with CFC that's an option. CFC can cover a person's first month of rent and utilities. So that was an issue with the first nursing home transition grants and I assume it wasn't in Money Follows the Person. I was less involved in Money Follows the Person. But sometimes that transition supports tell people get in the household on day one. That's not enough. You need to also help with that first month's rent. You know, most of us have rented at some point in our lives, and we know we have to have that first month's rent up front and often that first month of utilities. CFC allows that option. Moving on, Section 1915B waivers. These waivers allow states to require people to use managed care for Medicaid services. There's other authorities for voluntary managed care. I won't go into those. 1915B is requiring managed care. Then states choose which services are in managed care. You know, you can do a carve-out, say, for behavioral supports, which is pretty common, or you can target certain services, or you can have a comprehensive managed care program. Now, within 1915B, Section 1915B3 allows states to use savings from managed care to provide additional services to waiver enrollees. Those additional services can include housing transition services and tenancy sustaining services. So you can provide either that generalist approach within case management or kind of discrete services, such as we discussed for 1915C, I, and K. Those can be allowed within 1915B under the B3 option. The last authority to discuss is Section 1115 demonstrations. Section 1115 allows the Secretary for Health and Human Services to approve research and demonstration projects and test innovative service delivery systems. Demonstrations must be budget neutral for the federal government. Within 1115, there's a fair amount of flexibility subject to the federal requirements, but a major requirement is the budget neutrality. Some 1115 demonstrations do include housing transition services and tenancy sustaining services. Again, you can take that generalist approach within case management. You can provide discrete services. With 1115, you can provide those benefits that you can provide in 19 CFC, such as the first month's rent and utilities. But I think it's, you know, if you're interested in it, it's good to contact CMS and really work through what makes sense within that authority. Now I'd like to pass it on to Lynn Kovich to talk through the crosswalk that we're going to ask you to do in the next month.
Sorry, I was muted. Okay, thank you, Steve. So I want to talk a little bit about what it means to conduct a crosswalk of housing-related services and funding sources. So really concentrating in this particular VQ slide on the housing-related services and supports, knowing full well that people require other kinds of services, but for this exercise, wanted to limit it to the housing-related services. And so, gosh, as I've been at TAC, this question has been asked a number of times around getting an example of a state crosswalk. And the thing about crosswalks is if you've seen one crosswalk, you've seen one crosswalk, because they are so state-specific to the types of services that you guys are providing and the ways in which you're paying for them, that it really is a very state-singular kind of exercise. That being said, we will, as Steve said, be providing a template for you to really work from. And it really does give you, I think, a clear picture of what you're doing, and then it can really help you drive how you want to move ahead. So what is a crosswalk? And again, many of you have already done this and have gone through this exercise. Some of you are in the middle of doing it. So hoping that you will continue, and for states that haven't, hopefully this will be a good tool to get you started. So it really is a tool that guides the development of your strategy to include your housing-related services in your benefit packages. So what can it do? It will really help you, I think, begin to understand and kind of get a lay of the land of what you're doing right now. So what housing-related services are you currently providing? And to what populations are you providing them? What authorities are you using to pay for them, or what other funding sources are you using to pay for them? As well as, and we talked about this in a few slides ago, what services are not reimbursable by Medicaid that you would need to locate other sources because they're still very important to the entire package and to the individual being either being initially engaged or really being successful over the long term. And how are you paying for it? Are you reimbursing for fees for service? Are you paying through a contract rate? Are you paying through a case rate? So you really begin to, the picture will begin to evolve as you begin to populate. So, again, there's a lot of kind of, I think, key themes throughout this presentation. And this, again, you really have to coordinate this exercise with all of the other agencies. So, again, your Medicaid agency as well as your different service agencies, because you want to make sure that you're including the entire package of housing-related services that you define within your crosswalk. And, again, assessing who is paying for the services right now and who's providing them. So when you look across your providers and the services that you want to provide or are providing, are your providers, if it's a service that is currently not being funded by Medicaid but you find through your crosswalk that it is eligible for Medicaid funding, what do you have to do to ready your providers? What kind of technical assistance do you have to provide to them? What kind of infrastructures will they need to be able to bill Medicaid for the services that may be now being paid for through state funds? It will become very clear what Medicaid can and cannot pay for as you continue the exercise. And you'll see the role of Medicaid and other resources. So again, I just continue to emphasize that there will be other resources that are needed to be able to complete the picture, and Kevin talked about that in some of the in his slides. So what do you have to do to develop the crosswalk? It kind of sounds so easy when you see it in these slides, but it really is a pretty comprehensive and it's an exercise. It's a thing. It's something that will require a lot of time and effort on the part of you guys, and certainly for you, those of you who have already done it, you could certainly speak to that when we get back to opening it up for questions. But again, things you've already heard around identifying your proposed population, and it may be more than one population depending on your strategy. Again, you'll identify the range of the services you want to provide. And I think you can use the ID as a guide here, because I think that really, we'll go back to the slides that Kevin presented, it really talks about the services that you can do in a pretty clear, comprehensive way. You'll begin, I think, to see the gaps of what you're not providing as you begin to populate this on the form. You'll see what you're covering and again, how you're paying for them, what authorities you're using, and what non-Medicaid sources that you need to continue to use. So, you know, sometimes in states as things become converted to Medicaid and they're Medicaid eligible services, and now you're beginning to free up some state resources that had been previously funding these kinds of things. So at times a tendency, and in this climate, understand that to the mental health authority or the DD agency perhaps losing those funds, and really why you need to have your governor's office and your budget office as part of these discussions, because it really does take all of these services, I think, and all this funding to really make it work. How are you reimbursing for the services? So when I was in New Jersey, and Harry, you could chime in a bit, but, you know, we were paying a lot of the funds through state funds, through contracts. And so you really have to look, are you using your resources that you have in the most efficient way? And are you in these contract arrangements, are you getting what you're paying for? Are you, the amount of funding, are you getting the volume back in services? So you really want to take a look at how you're reimbursing. You may be paying fee for service. Is that the right way to do it? You might want to pay it on a case rate as opposed to a fee for service. How are your managed, if you're in a managed care environment, how are they reimbursing for the services? So you really begin to get a picture, and as, again, why I'm saying it's a pretty involved exercise to really go through all of these steps to really get a good picture. And again, you have to coordinate this with your Medicaid and your other agencies to develop your strategy, because in many cases, some of the other agencies may be paying for these services that can be reimbursable through Medicaid. So you need to involve everyone to develop your strategy. So what will it do? How will it help inform your work? And we're hoping that this really becomes your kind of action plan as you participate in this webinar series. As Steve said, we'll start to have you populate this between the first and the second webinar. So really allowing you to address your gaps across all of your service populations. What services are you not providing that you need to provide, or what services are you now providing that you can actually be billing Medicaid for? You'll determine your population. Again, a lot of this we've seen on the previous slide. And I, so kind of jumping down to the bottom bullet, you ultimately will get to what is the new service, what is the new definition. And hopefully, I think as Kevin kind of went through the slides and Steve went, or the services and Steve went through the authority, probably many of you are paying for them already, and you just need to coordinate it and make sure that the definition is really tight so that it can be covered by Medicaid. So ultimately, though, you'll want to see if you need to do any kind of modifications to your definitions or modification to your authorities, or determining if you need to develop a new waiver or a new authority to be able to pay for the services. So this is a screenshot of what the type of crosswalk, the template that we are going to be providing to you hopefully next week. So you could very clearly see along, this is the individual housing transition services, so those pre-tenancy kinds of services. So we just listed them out along that first column. The second column, or how are you paying for them? Is it already covered under Medicaid? Is it covered under another source? Is it covered, is it not covered at all? So you populate that based on how you're paying for stuff. if you are paying for it under Medicaid, what's the authority that you're currently using? And then as you go across, it talks about population, who's providing. So it just gives you a sense of what we're thinking. We try to make this, even though it's not simple, as concrete and simple as we could so that it's not this kind of burdensome exercise. Although I will say if I was standing in front of you and you were, I would probably say you would be throwing things at me at this point, because this is a thing. This is something that will take some time to complete if you want to really, really do it in the right way, so that it is a working document that, again, really clearly outlines your strategy and what you want to accomplish. So in summary, I think we've made this point several times throughout the presentation and kind of leading up to this, that housing-related services are integral to supporting individuals as they live in the community. They can benefit a broad range of individuals and a broad range of populations. And, you know, as you guys expressed your interest in participating, you talked about the different populations that you wanted to work with, that you wanted to include. And Melanie showed you that on one of the very, very first slides. So you can include a broad range of folks who you're working with. They can be included in several Medicaid authorities, as Steve pointed out as he was going through his piece of the presentation. So hopefully that gives you a sense of going back and looking at your authorities and seeing what's in there already, and hopefully only having to maybe do some updating of your definitions and some tweaking of your definitions. You really have to coordinate this across your system. So your Medicaid agency, across your sister division agency, so your behavioral health agency, your developmental intellectual disability agency, your long-term services and supports agency, your agency that works with people who are homeless. You really, when I was in New Jersey, in this environment, I would always say we're not getting a ton of new money, but we have to learn to use our resources more effectively. And so by having everyone at the table to see exactly who's paying for what, so that you can minimize any of the inconsistencies in the system to really get the most bang for your buck. So it really takes all of you being involved in this process. As Kevin said, that again, and I think I've said it as well, you all are probably paying for stuff, but you're not sure what each other is paying for. So really coordinating that, and you'll see that as you do the crosswalk. So I will end where I started this piece of the presentation, which is that the crosswalk is a tool that you can use to guide your development of a strategy to pay for housing-related services. And again, if states have done it, hopefully as we get to that piece, you might be able to share some of your experiences. So I'm going to turn it over to Melanie Brown now.
Thanks, Lynn. So we do have a few questions in the chat box from participants, and we're going to go through the questions in the chat box first, and then we'll go to the phone to see if anyone has any questions that they'd like to ask verbally. So we have a question from Betsy Benito. The question is, what is the benefit or challenge of the fact that some populations implicated in the CMS IB are in waivers now and some are not, like people with SMI and in IMDs are not in a waiver, but people with IDD are? So I'm going to ask if there's anyone from our either internal CMS folks or from our contracting partners who want to address that.
You know, I have a couple of thoughts, but I want to see if this is Steve Eichen. I have a couple of thoughts, but I want to pause and see if there's anyone from CMS that wants to address that first.
So, Steve, why don't you go ahead? I haven't gotten any flags yet from anyone internally.
Okay. Thanks. There's a couple thoughts I have. The first one is that a few states have been able to make 1915C waivers work for people with serious mental illness. Not many. About four states, I believe, last I checked, had waivers. Usually it was for nursing facility level of care, and they had a fair number of people in nursing facilities. It might be hospital level of care. So it's hard to make the cost effectiveness work, but it can be done depending on the state situation. The other thought is that a number of states have targeted 1915i programs to people with serious mental illness. And so that is a tool that can be used for that population. You know, obviously, a benefit of having a waiver established is that you have, you don't need to go through the process of developing the entire waiver application and the quality management strategy and all the internal processes that you need within a Medicaid program to make things work. But if you have a population that you want to serve that does not have this program set up already, there are options. I actually provides a fair amount of flexibility. There's examples. There's a CMS website that lists all the waivers and state plan. Well, one for waivers and one for state plan amendments. And you can go there and download. You can search for 1915i and see what states have done with their 1915i programs. And I'd be happy to help to send a link or kind of show you examples. It can be done. I is an option. B3 is an option that's been used more for people with serious mental illness and less for people with developmental disabilities and older adults, people with physical disabilities, people with brain injuries, et cetera. 1915B has been used more in the behavioral health space, but there's nothing specifically excluding it in that space. It seems to have worked out for states better, but there's options. I don't know if any states have thoughts on that question. I think it's #7 to unmute.
And while we're waiting for them to unmute, I mean, I would like to, this is Mike Smith again from CMS, I'd like to restate that for folks on the phone that may not be aware, there is a SUD track of the IAP effort, and that track is looking into issues around sustainable efforts to support people who have SUD in Medicaid. So I would encourage folks to go to the Learning Collaborative area of Medicaid.gov for IAP and look up the SUD work. There is a, I think there is some materials there that might be useful to helping with that question as well.
And it's Kevin, if I could just add, you think about the types of services that an individual may need coming out of an IMD or an ICF, for instance, and they may need generally the same types of housing-related services, but by the nature of the type of facility they're in or the nature of their disability, they might be, eligible or ineligible for certain services. I would think about it from, what are the services that the person needs? It goes back to my earlier point in terms of, sometimes facility-based services may be providing some of these pre-tenancy type of supports, so like for instance in an IMD, it may be the state psychiatric hospital staff that are initially beginning to provide these pre-tenancy supports, for the most part on the state dollar. But, at some point when they're discharged into the community, they're going to be eligible for some Medicaid waiver or state plan service that Steve had gone through, and at that point that state may be covering those housing related services in that program versus the waiver program for a person for a person with ID DD coming out of an ICF, for instance.
Thanks everyone. So there was the next question was from Rick Wilcox, and I think Lynn, you addressed this, but you might want to repeat it. When the states will receive the template for the crosswalk?
Oh yes, hopefully within the week.
Okay. And the next question is from Jennifer Reed. Will there be examples of housing transition services that states could use to include as part of the crosswalk? These would be the services needed to locate housing? That last part is a question.
Yeah, it's Kevin. So the crosswalk sample that people will get will generally have a list of housing-related services from a pre-tenancy and then a tenancy-sustaining perspective identified in the left-hand column. And there's going to be a a second tab that will go with that. Will provide a sort of a general description of those services for everybody, so that everybody's sort of working from a basic, you know, perspective, which should be helpful. You know, and within that, you know, you should be able to identify, all right, you know, a specific service that relates to helping a person locate housing. That might be, you know, as that plays out at the direct service level, you know, that might be some sort of caseworker, housing specialist, or transition coordinator, you know, working with an individual to identify potential housing, which could be working with a housing locator website, or working through the newspapers to find available apartments, to actually accompanying them on visiting potential sites, to visiting sites, to meeting with landlords and things like that.
Thanks, Kevin. So the next question was from Kelly Cinco. The question is, will the slides or a crosswalk template as previously shown be available after the webinar to use in our work on creating the crosswalk? So this, for the slides piece, we're working on that. As soon as we've been able to make sure that they're 508 compliant, we will send out a PDF version of the slides. And I think, as Lynn just said, the crosswalk template should be available next week.
Yeah, and the slides will be available this week. I've been able to confirm that with our staff.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Next question is from Rebecca Melange. In Minnesota, we've done a comprehensive crosswalk in the past, but it lacks to show the true gaps. The problem exists in that we have several Medicaid programs that cover the services listed, but the limitations of either population or how this service is delivered makes it unusable. So that's a comment. Any thoughts or feedback?
You know, it's probably good to think about this, and Kevin and Lynn, you've done this a few more times than I have, but it might be good to do crosswalks for particular populations, especially if there's a special emphasis within the state, so that you can catch those gaps. And frankly, looking at the multiple populations, you might find out, okay, we have one waiver that does this, and we don't do it in the other waiver. Maybe we need to see if we can get that service into the other waiver. And I'm speaking waivers just because I know Minnesota, and I at least I used to know Minnesota. I used to work there. I think that's how these supports would be provided.
One thought could be, and I just don't know because I haven't looked at Minnesota, is, you know, also looking at it beyond the Medicaid perspective, right? So, you know, if you have particular housing-related services covered for one population group through a waiver, and you identify what's covered by Medicaid and what's not covered by Medicaid. And so you may have identified what's covered by Medicaid. Then you look at another population that may be covered by another Medicaid, you know, like a state plan service, right? And you see that they're not necessarily identical because of the way the waiver and the state plan service were constructed. To me, then, the question is, if you're sort of stuck in that framework, how do other non-Medicaid services fill those gaps for the population served by the waiver and the population served by the state plan service? You know, and so that may look a little different. You know, maybe the state Medicaid agency wants to try to streamline that across the board and try to get rid of those gaps. But if that's not possible at the end of the day, you're still probably going to have some non-Medicaid resources that are going to have to fill those gaps, and that may look a little different based upon the population, if that makes sense.
Thanks.
Okay.
Go ahead.
This is Allie Nemi from Minnesota. I'm sitting here with Rebecca, too. And so I think your comments helped. I think by doing it by population would help. I just wanted to kind of mention the fact that, you know, we've done these in the past, and we have a lot of different, actually quite probably too many services that and funding sources that provide housing-related services. But just saying, you know, checking yes or no on a crosswalk doesn't really show, like, why people aren't accessing them, why the target populations we're looking at, people who are chronically homeless, aren't actually getting those services. The reasons are a lot more nuanced, more to do with eligibility factors or funding limitations or just how the service provided doesn't work for that population. So, like, how do we get at kind of showing some of those nuances? And then also, we might not want all those services. We might want it to be simpler. We might not have to have someone try to, you know, find which of the 20-some different programs that we operate do they fit into so they access these services. It, you know, that might be, I feel like, one of the directions we're going. So just a little cautious about the crosswalk, and kind of it ends up looking like we have all these services already and they're already covered. So what's the problem?
Yeah. No, that's a really great observation, right? I mean, I think what we're hoping here is to give, you know, states a tool to sort of begin that process. But I think your points about sort of taking it to implementation, and, you know, there's a whole lot of other challenges that go along with that, you know, in terms of, and I think Lynn had mentioned it earlier, in terms of provider training, expectation, you know, methods of reimbursement, you know, things like that. It's certainly a complicated process.
And I think that, so it sounds like your crosswalk is telling you something. So it's then kind of taking it to the next level to dig down to some of those things, because some of it may be engagement or provider training kinds of issues. And maybe, I don't know how long ago you've done it either, maybe to kind of take another look and update it as well.
So we have a few other questions that have come in. So I'm going to skip over some of the comments, and if we have time, we'll come back. I just want to make sure that we can try and address most of the questions. So here's a question from Betsy Aiello. How do you make housing transition screen and support plan not duplicative of services for someone that needs case management for other issues such as medical or mental health care? Would this work with transition services in 1915I and allow companion TCM or medical home for the other services? So we'll open that up for any of our co-presenters who would like to address the question.
I have some thoughts. I don't know, Steve, if you have any thoughts to add.
Yeah, go ahead and start.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it gets back to the issue of, you know, we're obviously talking, I mean, many of the individuals that we're talking about here have pretty complex conditions and, you know, require a lot of support and may have multiple folks, you know, working in their lives. And it really sort of, to me, gets to that care coordination concept. You know, I'm really trying to, you know, coordinate, you know, the types of services that people will be receiving and being clear about those roles and responsibilities, you know, and that may mean that, you know, a tenancy, a housing-related service or some sort of tenancy service, you know, may be provided through one particular Medicaid authority, and some of the other services may be provided through another Medicaid authority, like, you know, I think you had here, like medical home or health homes, for instance. You know, I think California is sort of thinking of, you know, structuring things that way where, you know, some tenancy-type services may be covered through one area, but, you know, some more of the other types of services that a person would need might be covered from another authority and may involve multiple people.
Thanks, Kevin. Steve, did you want to add anything?
No, I think it really depends on the specific scopes of service within each one. And you know, sometimes the general case management service doesn't really get to the depth that you need for the housing support and how to fine-tune that so you don't have concerns about duplication of service. Yeah, I could see where it could be tricky, and it might, you know, some dialogue with your regional office may be useful just to help make sure you're keeping all the ducks in a row.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin and Steve. The next question is from Laura Baker. So should we consider adding housing-related services and supports to a variety of our 9-1915C waivers and create a new waiver for persons with SMI? And again, open up for anyone. If our CMS folks are on the phone and want to address, it's just *7, and or for many of our contracting staff as well.
I mean, I guess consider it a broad perspective, but I think what we're hoping to do with the crosswalk is think first in terms of what people need, what's happening now, and then think about how you can do it. And that how you can do it may well be add sports to all your waivers and create a new waiver. It might be something different. But kind of starting with what do people need and how is it happening now, I think at least that's been more helpful as I've been thinking about it. Kevin or Lynn, I don't know if you have other thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think it's doing exactly what you just said, Steve, and then really thinking about your state and your program to develop the appropriate either waiver or state plan service. You know, it's so, as I said in the beginning, they're so state specific, but it's really about getting down on paper what you're doing now and then what folks need and how you're paying for it, to kind of guide you to make some of those decisions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, think about it. I mean, I think there's different approaches, right? There are some states that are really thinking about, you know, they're taking a whole new look at their overall Medicaid strategy, you know, broadly. And, you know, as part of that broad, you know, strategy development, they're looping this into the conversation, you know, and, you know, that may mean sort of a consolidation of things and trying to incorporate these types of services into that approach. You may have some other states that are then, or other states who have, you know, really worked it into, you know, the same type of supports into several different waivers or state plan services so that they've got it consistent, but it's written in as consistently as it can be across those Medicaid authorities within the state.
Yeah, I would echo that as well, Kevin. This is Mike Smith from CMS, and I think if you're currently operating a Money Follows the Person program and you're thinking about these services and you have them in as a demonstration or supplemental services within your program or waiver eligible services, you may want to think about where the individuals you're serving through that program are moving to as a first point of reference. But I would also sort of echo again or restate what Kevin said is, I think it's really helpful to consider this service as, you know, as consistently as possible, so that, you know, when you provide training and efforts to create a provider base that can do this work effectively, that you have it done in a consistent manner that's going to be effective for everyone.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Kevin. So the next question was about the dates for the next webinar from Jonathan McDay. When will the dates for the next webinar be shared? I don't think we've actually determined the dates for webinar 2 and 3. Is that right, Steve?
Actually, we recently determined webinar 2, and that's going to be the next slide.
Oh, great. So we have one other question before we move to the next slide from Ashley Tolman. And her question was, could the crosswalk be adjusted to account for services that are technically covered in the state Medicaid plan but not covered in practice due to funding limitation? Lynn or Kevin, did you want to address that related to the crosswalk?
I think that you could adjust it in how you think it makes sense for your state so that you understand what you can and what you can't provide. I mean, we might have to take a look at the crosswalk to see exactly how you would capture that, but you know, remember this is your tool, and you could devise it to capture exactly what you need it to capture so that you really get a true picture of what's happening. I don't know, Kevin, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think it's probably right, Lenny. I think I think the idea would be you could sort of take this and work with this tool to suit your needs. So
you know, it's an interesting point. We could certainly take it back and kick it around a little bit further.
Thanks, Lynn and Kevin. So with that, I will turn it back over to Steve.
Thanks, Melanie. And I'll click to the next slide for the remaining webinars. The next webinar will be March 30 from 2:30 to 4:30 Eastern, so the same time, same day of the week. We'll focus on state examples of Medicaid coverage of housing-related services. We'll have two or three states present, have a lot of room for Q&A. In April, we'll focus – we don't have the date selected yet. It will be a Tuesday or Wednesday. It'll be in the afternoon, but we haven't pinned it down yet. And the focus there is implementation planning based on lessons learned from experienced states. Some of you we've reached out to you already. Some of you we will reach out to you. For that webinar, we're going to look more topic by topic, you know, in terms of how do we address implementation issues that we think will come up as those of you that are implementing the service would do so. One theme that came up today that I had not heard much before, I'd heard a little bit, was around eligibility. So that, you know, that's another topic we've discussed before, and I'm feeling more confident we should include that in webinar three. We'll be responsive to what we're hearing from you all. Based on state needs, we might do additional calls with small groups of states on particular topics of interest. So let us know if there's particular questions as you're doing your crosswalk. Things may come up, and we might see themes and try to get small groups together. On the next slide, if you have additional questions, please let me know. My email is in the slide. It's steve.eiken@truvenhealth.com. And include the subject line tenancy so I can just kind of keep them all straight. If you don't do that, I won't hold it against you, but it will help me. I want to thank you for joining today's webinar. Melanie, I see a chat comment, and I'm not sure what it is, so I kind of want to pause before saying goodbye and thank you in case there's something we need to share.
So it looks like a couple other questions did come in. One is from North Carolina, Trish Farnham. North Carolina is currently drafting a tenancy support service definition. Will TA be available to review? So, Steve, I thought that the last slide sort of addressed that there may be some group TA available to states by request, based on, you know, the needs of the states, but it would most likely be sort of group-based technical assistance.
Yes, and if other states are interested in kind of reviewing definitions, that would be a good topic.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. I'm just taking a quick look down the chat box again. There is a response that I'm going to send out to everybody, or actually, if Hannah, if you could send out Debbie's response regarding the crosswalk to everyone. But I think that's it, Steve.
Great. Well, everyone, really appreciate your time today. Thank you for joining the webinar. We have a short survey that's important for our evaluation that will follow the webinar, so please hang on and fill that out, and thank you very much.